Our next case, which is Forrest v. Prine. Mr. Carman.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bruce Carman. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Roger Forrest. Your Honors, I'm going to argue this case slightly backwards from the manner in which it's presented in the briefs. The first issue that I want to discuss is Magistrate Gorman's finding that there was no genuine issue of material fact with respect to the question of whether Defendant Prine wantonly, intentionally, or recklessly deployed the taser in this case.
Well, what do you think the police or these prison guards or whatever, what should they have done?
What should the prison guards have done? I certainly, as it pertains to the argument that I'm beginning with, they certainly shouldn't have fired the taser
into
the...
What should they have done?
What they should have done was, if they determined that the only way to secure compliance with their request for the most intimate aspects of a strip search, they could have taken the taser device, taken one step to Mr. Forrest, and stuck it right in his chest. And I assume that would have secured compliance. The record shows that Mr. Forrest had been subdued by a taser earlier in the evening by the Rock Island City Police.
So you're not objecting to the taser as such, just to the to where it was aimed? Or?
No, I think secondarily I'm objecting to the taser as such. I think I can construct an argument, Your Honors, that what the police could have done, what the correctional officers could have done in this situation was taken a more measured approach. Mr. Forrest wasn't going anywhere. He was massively...
Well, I guess that gets back to Judge Posner's original question. What's the more measured approach? Use of batons?
Well, no, they could have eschewed the strip search entirely, first of all.
Well, I know, but that you can't do.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, if you're doing a
That'd be the end of strip searches, right?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a horrible thing in this instance, Your Honor.
Well, I know, but I don't think we have that authority to say no more strip searches.
No, but you have the authority to determine what is an excessive amount of force necessary to ensure compliance.
Okay, so we have no tasers and no batons. Now what?
No, I'm not saying no tasers and no batons. I'm saying that a taser in a certain circumstance is appropriate.
Well,
I think I made that fairly clear in my brief.
In this case,
I think from other cases, in fact, Your Honor, you'll see that the courts allow the use of this, what I would call less than lethal force, in situations where the officer is either at a disadvantage or where there is a possibility of flight. In this situation, the officers had Forrest badly outmanned, essentially cornered into a small holding cell with somewhere between 2 to 4.
So what should they do?
So what they should do, well, of course, like I said, my first suggestion you've already rejected, which is nothing, and not do the strip search at all, because there's no reason to believe that he's carrying any contraband or any weapons on him, based upon everything they knew from the Rock Island City Police. But that's not the basis of our argument today. What they should have done was they should have said, if you do not comply, here is a taser device. What we're going to do is take this taser device and stick it in your chest. And if you don't do this, or we're going to say, we're going to give you 15 seconds. Give my client a chance. Now, I understand the record does say that he was warned, but the record also shows that there was quite a bit of noise going on at this time, most of it, some of it being generated by my client, some of it being generated by the correctional officer. But I'd like to redirect the court, because I think that the issue that's most critical in this case is based upon Magistrate Gorman's determination that it is not a reasonable inference that Correctional Officer Prine wantonly, recklessly, or cruelly deployed this taser in such a manner to fire the dart from a distance of 6 to 10 feet and had him strike my client within an inch of his right eye. The reason that the magistrate came to that conclusion, I don't know. But it seems to me that in this circumstance, what the magistrate is supposed to be doing is determining if there are genuine issues of material fact and not resolving genuine issues of material fact. My concern is that the magistrate is using something like a modernistic Occam's razor, in the sense that if it has a choice between determining that Prine negligently or carelessly deployed the taser in this case, or intentionally, you know, I'll show you, deploy the taser so as to nearly strike my client in his eye. I think.
What was it your client indicated that he said that Officer Payne or Correctional Officer Payne was pointing at his face?
He said, get the taser out of my face, which is ambiguous, because there's the street version of that, which is don't aim that taser at me, and then there's the common sense version of it, which is the taser is directed towards my face. At this stage of the case, my client is entitled to all reasonable inferences, and one of the reasonable inferences is that it was aimed at his face, and the proof of the pudding, of course, is that's where it ended up.
Except all the other testimony was that the dot was on the torso.
Well, the testimony of the interested defendant police...
Did his cousin testify?
His cousin testified, but he was not present at that point. The officers that were present at that point were Prine, Mendoza, possibly Lieutenant Young. Those are the officers who gave affidavits or testifies to what they saw precisely at the moment. But we all know what happened. We all know where this taser dart ended up. And the question is, did it end up there as the result of an accident, or did it end up there as the result of intentional conduct? And I think it's a very reasonable inference, based upon some of the other factors in this case, that it was intentional. Correctional Officer Prine testified that he was trained in the use of the taser. He understood the two different methods of deployment.
But wasn't the injury from falling rather than from the little dart of the taser?
Well, the ultimate injury of the depression fracture of the cheekbone came from the falling, but again, at this stage of the case, we don't know if there's a proximate cause problem that I might have, showing that the firing into the eye caused a particular kind of derangement that would cause one to fall. I mean, I think one of the things that we've read in the record about taser application is it doesn't necessarily stop you. I mean, one of the things we've read from all the other cases is that there are people who are tased multiple times and continue standing. In fact, just again, way outside the record, but an interesting little anecdote is we had a situation out in the Quad Cities a few years ago, might have been within the last year, where a man was tased multiple times and kept coming at the police officers, and they eventually had to shoot him.
Yeah, the results vary, don't they?
Yes. And so, but what we do know is that if you fire a taser dart into somebody's eye, it's going to have some severe consequences.
Well, it didn't hit his eye.
It did not hit, I said near his eye. And I guess my question that I as a person who deals with these things quite often is, what would happen if he shot him in the eye? Now, I know that didn't happen here, but would it change the magistrate's analysis of whether Prine's conduct was particularly wanton and cruel under the subjective component of the Eighth Amendment test for excessive force under these circumstances? Should the law change based upon
Well, if he were aiming at his eye, yeah, but I didn't think you didn't think he actually was aiming at his eye.
Oh, I most certainly am suggesting he was aiming at his face.
At his eye?
Well, if you read the record, Your Honor, Correctional Officer Prine had every reason to be very upset with my client. My client had steadfastly refused to accede to his demands. He had called him some rather choice names, and in fact, the record shows that this went on for a little bit. This didn't happen over the course of 10 or 15 seconds. This went over the course of a few minutes. I assume that things were rather tense at that time, and I assume that Correctional Officer Prime was probably getting a little bit peeved at my client and said, and I guess at this stage of the case, on a motion for summary judgment, I'm entitled to the inference that Prime said, that's enough. I'm going to show this man. And he certainly did. And the proof of the pudding, Your Honor, is that's where the dart ended up. It certainly looks like a trained correctional officer like Prine, who knows that he could have, like I said, taken one step forward and popped the taser into my client's chest and accomplished the same purpose, made a calculated choice not to do that.
Where'd the other dart go?
Into his left forearm. But there's testimony that as part of this little dance here, the taser went into the eye and struck the forearm. There was testimony from the correctional officers that when the taser was deployed, Forrest did do something to try to protect himself from it, and that's where it ended up. So that's kind of a strange thing that it hits him here and hits him here. So there has to be some kind of movement there in order to make that happen. Again, this is, I wouldn't say it's speculation, but at this stage of the case, I'm entitled to the advocate. I'm entitled to that inference, and that's critical because the whole issue of qualified immunity, I believe, goes by the wayside if the court determines, because there is no reasonable set of facts under which a police officer, a correctional officer, can think that he can intentionally deploy a taser into somebody's face. Had he deployed the taser in the manner that I suggested, there would probably be a very interesting and close case on qualified immunity, but I'm entitled to the inference that he meant to do this. And if he meant to do this, Your Honor, I think that qualifies as excessive force.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carman. Mr. Martins?
May it please the court, counsel. I think Mr. Carman made a key point there, and what he's entitled to under the summary judgment standard is he's entitled to for the court to draw reasonable inferences in his favor in this case. And for the court to get to that position, they would have to draw the reasonable inference that he did. It was intending to aim it at his eye when he was pointing the taser in the cell. As the facts have established in the record as it is to date, there's undisputed evidence that there was a red dot on Mr. Forrest's torso as he was pacing around in the cell. That is not undisputed by Mr. Forrest in any way, and as the district court pointed out, he couldn't have disputed it because he wouldn't have been able necessarily to be able to see the dot on his chest or his torso as he was pacing around. Mr. Forrest admits that he was moving around, in his words, like a cat in the back of the cell, and even indicates that he moved to the left as the taser was deployed. So it is undisputed that he's moving around, making himself a moving target. He's clearly agitated. He's yelling at the officer. He is refusing to comply. And the officer is faced with the situation where really he's got a ticking time bomb. He has a gentleman in the cell who he knows has just assaulted another police officer within the hour. He knows that it was assaulting a family member. He knows that he has come in and he has become agitated, angry. He's refusing to comply with the strip search command, in which Mr. Forrest undisputedly indicates that he'd been in there before and knew that the procedure to submit to those things. And basically, he was left with a situation where this gentleman was refusing to comply with the standard order that was being given to him, and it got to the point where the taser was deployed, shown to him, and he was repeatedly warned that it would have to be used if he would not comply. And he continued not to comply. It's not like any of the cases where it was just brought out and fired at him without any warning or any provocation in any manner. And it was a clear situation in which it was necessary for the officer to maintain control of the situation in the cell and the discipline in order to get him to comply with the request. It's also a situation where, under the second prong of the qualified immunity test, where the plaintiff has failed to provide the proof that a reasonable officer under this situation would know that this was not proper for him to do this under these circumstances. As has been indicated, the only real case in this circuit in which the taser has explicitly been discussed is the recent Lewis case, which explicitly held that the use of the taser is permissible under proper circumstances.
How far away was Prine from Forrest when he fired the taser?
Prine was anywhere from 6 to 10 feet, I think he testified, Your Honor. The cell's about that deep, and he was standing in the doorway. And I think, as he indicated, he did not feel it was safe for him to approach Mr. Forrest. Obviously, he was in a situation where they were trying to complete the strip search. The idea being, they have no idea if he has any contraband on him because he's come from the outside, and that's what they're trying to make sure, that he doesn't have some contraband somewhere on his body, which would pose a danger to him or the officers, or if they released him, you know, into the general population, anyone else in the jail. So he's in there with the situation with this man who has shown that evening the capacity and the desire to fight with law enforcement officials. He didn't feel it was safe for him to approach Mr. Forrest to stick it in his chest or do anything further because he was afraid for his own safety as well as Mr. Forrest's safety in trying to get up with him and risk a physical hands-on confrontation as well. But for the idea that the taser, first taser dart struck his cheek, I don't think that there would really be much of any question here. The use in this taser of the taser in this type of situation seems to be permissible by this court from the Lewis case and the other circuits which have looked at this issue and found that under the Eighth Amendment, there is a need to maintain order and control in a setting such as a jail setting, and that there's only a deprivation of the constitutional right if it's used maliciously or wantonly. We don't believe that there's any evidence here at all in the record which would show that it was used maliciously or wantonly. If indeed, you know, there was some, you know, negligence or mistake made at the moving target, and when he ducked or moved, he actually, you know, brought the target down and he got struck in the cheek instead of where the taser dot was originally located, the officer should still be protected under qualified immunity, because that doctrine provides that it protects situations where a mistake is made in that a constitutional violation is only found where there is willful or malicious actions. And it's clear in this case also under the second portion of the second prong of the qualified immunity test that this was not patently offensive behavior in using the taser in the manner that he did. Obviously, he was trying to control the situation. There's no doubt there was a verbal give and take for some period of time while he tried to get him to comply, and he simply would not comply. And the use of the taser, therefore, became really the only safe alternative for the officer under that situation, or what he believed at that time. And the recent case that was decided by this court in Escobedo also talks in a different context, in a tear gas context, but also talks about a situation where it could be known to the officer that what he was doing, you know, so patently violated the person's constitutional rights that he would be on notice that it was not proper for him to do what he was doing. Certainly this case is very distinguishable from the fact situation in Escobedo, where there was 12 times the amount of tear gas used on a gentleman who was really posing no threat to the security or the safety of the officers, and flashbang devices were used. Similarly, in the Lewis case, this case is very distinguishable from that case as well, where this court found that the use of taser in that situation was not proper because the inmate himself was on a hunger strike and was laying on a bench and was in a very quieted and almost a delirious state, and they gave him one order, he didn't comply, and he was tased. Clearly, we don't have that type of situation here. Instead, we have a very agitated, angry, uncompliant gentleman who had not even completed a strip search so that they could tell that he was, you know, safe to be even booked and brought into the jail. And multiple warnings were given to this gentleman, and he would not comply. We think that the district court was correct in analyzing this case as it did, and in indicating that it's only while it is required to construe all disputed material facts and draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiff, it need only draw a reasonable inferences. And what the plaintiff, or what Mr. Forrest is trying to indicate, is that somehow he's entitled that every inference that could be drawn should be drawn in his favor. And clearly that's not the case. In the Springer case, which we cited, there was indication that it's not enough to just argue mere conjecture or hunches that this might have been what happened because, you know, something else happened in that situation. In this case, it's not enough to say, well, just because he was shot in the cheek, that it must have been that he intended or that he willfully and maliciously intended to try to shoot the taser in Mr. Forrest's face in that situation. And we feel that the facts that have been established clearly do not support that inference in this situation, and that instead the facts clearly show that what he was intending could be objectively seen, because it was the dot was seen by at least three individuals in this case, and Mr. Forrest could not in any way rebut that or dispute that, because he was talking with Mr. Prine and he was not actually looking at the torso on his chest. We clearly feel that the district court was proper in analyzing this case and finding that the plaintiff has failed to meet his burden of proof in establishing that there was a material issue of disputed fact that would allow him to recover under a violation of either the 8th or the 14th or the 4th Amendment rights in this situation, and that qualified immunity also would prevent any cause of action from going forward for the plaintiff under both analysis of both prongs, as the court did analyze both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis, and would ask that this court uphold the district court's ruling on the summary judgment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martins. Mr. Carman, your time expired. We'll give you another minute, though.
That's all I need, Your Honor. Thank you.
I think this an affirmance of the magistrate, of the judgment of the district court would send two very bad messages. Bad message number one would be to correctional officers, that they have, that they can pretty much do anything to secure compliance with their requests. And when I say anything, I'm not just saying the use of the taser, but that they can use the taser in any way they want because the subject isn't going to be able to challenge them. He's not going to be able to see where they were training their red dot. That sends a very dangerous message. But I think the more systemically dangerous message is the message sent to judges. It's sent to judges to say that if you don't think that somebody intended to do something, if that's your gut instinct, if that's what you feel, if you don't feel the evidence is very strong that somebody meant to do something, well, you just find that it's not a reasonable inference. Well, in this case, we have pretty much a smoking gun. We have a dart in this man's cheek at less than an inch from his eye. I think that's the smoke that shows that there's fire. It shows that he meant to do that. As far as this dot being trained on the chest, Mr. Martins made one very telling point. At some point, Prine trained the dot on the chest, but the testimony is not clear that the dot was trained on the chest at the moment that he fired, because
you're saying that every time that a taser hits a person's face, you have a jury trial.
I'm saying under the circumstances of this case, under the facts of this case,
it's just that he was hit in the face. There isn't any other circumstance.
Except that this is not a situation where he's running away. This is not a situation where we're out in an open space. We have a trained officer who knows how to use this thing, who's got it holding it with two hands. So he's aiming it. He's actually, in a calculated fashion, aiming it. I think that leads to a very reasonable inference, Judge, that it ended up exactly where he meant it to end up. And if that's so, I think a jury could draw a conclusion that that was wanton, cruel, and calculated, and therefore a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Carman and Mr. Martins. Last